Welcome to TA1, everything you want to know about adventure racing, and then some. I'm your host, legendary Randy Erickson, and you're in for a treat this week. Adrian has been on my wish list for a long time, and it took Eco Challenge to get him. So in this one, maybe surprisingly, will be a very excellent episode for beginners and new racers. Adrian's got a lot of philosophies and insights that will really, really help you out. So, yeah, if you're a newbie, listen to this one. It's important. In other news, I'll be in Georgia next weekend, depending on when you listen to this, at the Bear, the Blairsville Extreme Adventure Race. And Jeff also announced today, which is, I don't know, we're in the middle of September, the Solo National Championships next year in November. So that should be fairly exciting for all you soloers out there. I always thought this was a team sport, but hey, I like most of you. So you get your own national championships. So there you go. Okay, let's do this. Go fast, take chances, leave a review, leave a donation, and thanks for listening. Peace out. Bye. Adrian, how are you?
I'm good. Hold on a second. That's probably voice. Okay.
Oh, you sound good.
Good, good, good.
So let me do this right here. Okay. How smoky is it?
It's a little better today, and it certainly feels better because it's no longer, 95 or 100. It's only low 80s, but it is totally socked in, so it's probably smoky up there.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure which is worse. We had 8 inches of snow 2 days ago.
Did you really? And where are you?
In South Dakota.
Oh, okay.
It was a real bizarre thing, but
yeah, I've got two sons in Denver, so they got a bit of snow and said the temperature dropped like 60 degrees in one day.
yeah, we went from 100 on like Friday to snow.
Crazy.
So we're having a couple of racers for virtual nationals here, and they're going to be in the water a lot, and there's still a little snow on the ground, but. It's warmed up.
All right. Okay. Okay. I just watched the trailer for Patagonia. if that's really the part of Patagonia we're going to, it's going to be epic. So.
Well, I don't think there's any place in Patagonia that's not epic, right?
Well, you're kind of right, but it's a little, a little less extreme if you're a bit further north. So.
Yeah. Have you raced there before?
Yeah, I've done Raid Argentina and Eco Challenge Argentina, which were both northern Patagonia. So, Bariloche area, if you know it.
A little bit. It's we have to pretend, our dog Chili came from down there, so that's kind of her home territory.
Oh, very fun. Okay.
Yeah. So, all right. I got a lot of things I want to ask you.
Okay. So you're just going to you're just going to record, or you're writing down, or?
No, we're just going to record this. We're going to talk, and then sometime next week, the whole world is going to hear us.
All right. I'll be on my best behavior. Okay.
Yeah. Well, you don't have to be.
I know. So,
okay. Did you take a pair of roller skis to the Badwater?
They were not roller skis. They were just regular old, actually pretty skinny track skis, and there was absolutely no glide to be had. So really, they were just planks of wood to spread the load. And, people seem to think I got some kind of, advantage from using skis. Such as roller skis, but no, there was no advantage to be had, no mechanical advantage in them. And I just used them for a few hundred yards across the softest part of the mud.
Okay, so you were just being smart.
Exactly, and I was being smart because I had learned my lesson the year before when I went in up to my thigh in glutinous mud and, you know, was basically, you know, stranded in the middle of Death Valley and Badwater at noon, half covered in mud and 2 miles away from getting back to the main road.
And are you off the main road for competitive reasons, so to speak?
Yes, I intentionally went for what I called a more aesthetic line, more like a straight line between the lowest and highest points. I personally think it's a little silly to create a race from the lowest and highest points that have been there for probably millions of years and certainly hundreds of thousands of years, and then to say, oh, by the way, you've got to use a road that's been there for 80 years. So I think it's much, much more interesting, much more of a challenge, and much more correct to choose your own route.
And I think sounds like maybe that's a theme.
It is a bit of a theme, yes.
So, okay, well, no roller skis. You just use skinny skis for a real reason.
Correct.
I don't know. I like the myth a little bit better.
Oh, you do? I'm not sure. I like I like using the correct tool to do what it was intended to do. And yeah, I'd have had to stay on the main road if I wanted to use those roller skis, wouldn't I? Yeah.
That's true. That's true. And that would be cheating, not creative problem solving.
Yeah, it wouldn't be very imaginative, put it that way.
Yeah. So, you're not from California, are you?
No, I'm not. I must have gained a little bit of the accent from here, but I still retain a lot of my old English from England, northwest England in the Lake District.
I've heard the Lake District. What is the Lake District?
Well, the Lake District is a very beautiful area of what we call mountains, but they're small hills and lakes. It's very well known for being the home of several famous poets like Wordsworth and Shelley. And it is a wonderful place to be raised. In my teen years, we could wander around the hills and sail and kayak on the lakes. And I'd probably have been quite happy if I stayed there, but I was encouraged to come to California, and here I still am.
What brought you to California?
That would be a woman.
That old chestnut.
That's the one. So that's my wife, Karen, who is still here. And that is she of the quote that created the episode title for episode 8 of World's Toughest Race. Only the crazy ones are sane.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people listening that probably don't realize that they're part of that.
I think they should they should be attempting to be a part of that.
And have you always been like that from young? Did you get kicked out of the house and told don't come back till dark?
Was pretty close to it, but quite often it was actually my father and my uncle who would come out of the house with us and stay out till dark with us. So, my uncle and my father were very much into the outdoors. They were keen climbers. And you need to realize that this was England in the early 60s, and we'd had the fun of being the first country the country that claimed to have climbed Everest first. Of course, there were New Zealanders and Indians, but led by the British and organized by the British. So mountaineering was a big thing in Britain at the time, and my uncle and my father, along with many other people, were just dead keen to get out on the hills, go rock climbing. And as soon as myself and my brothers were old enough, we were encouraged to do the same.
Very cool. So did they I mean, that was kind of like the golden age of mountaineering everywhere, right?
Well, I think it was, and it was. It's not quite true to say it was the national sport of England, but it was, very widespread and well respected. You didn't get strange looks when you said you were going climbing. Everybody knew about it, and everybody encouraged it. So, as with anything that's got that kind of support, it was a lot of fun to be involved in.
So did you gravitate to mountaineering, or were you started on expeditions, or was it, rock climbing in the Lakes District?
No, we were basically hikers and peak baggers and mountaineers. And what happened was we very quickly outgrew our local small mountains and would head up to the north of Scotland to climb their tougher mountains, very commonly in the middle of winter, which made them into quite good expedition possibilities. And I ended up doing a lot of tromping around in the snow in Scotland in the middle of winter and learning a lot of skills, I think. But definitely mountaineering was the primary attraction at the time.
What's what makes you want to go up in the middle of winter and do that? I mean, I understand in the summer when it's nice, but that winter stuff is a...
Well, that's a very good question, but I think, and this really does get at maybe the crux of what has bugged me all my life, which is if something is too easy, you don't quite get the satisfaction if and when you succeed. And so to go out on a sunny day in the north of England in summer and climb a small mountain and perhaps get a little downpour of rain for half an hour just didn't have the excitement and the challenge. And it's possibly because at the time, I would be reading books on the great Himalayan expeditions and people sacrificing their bodies to make it to the top of a mountain, and well, I don't want to do that. Certainly the more harrowing the trip or the more difficult it was, the more of a sense of achievement we had if we did get to the top of something.
Did it make you feel like Mallory? Weather like that?
Yeah, I think it really did. That was what we were trying to emulate, and luckily we had a group by that time of brothers and cousins and a couple of friends who were all willing to join in and try some fairly tough trips. They weren't cutting edge, but they were pretty tough, and there weren't many other people up there climbing in the wilds of Scotland in winter. So we could imagine ourselves as quite the Himalayan heroes if we made it up to a snowy summit.
Yeah, well, hey, I get it. I mean, we have to have our little things growing up, especially.
Yeah, yeah.
Our heroes.
Yep.
So, how long did it take you to go to the Himalayas?
Well, actually, it took 10 years to get there. We had to go to college first and university and at least get a first job. But in 1983, when I was probably 27, my brother and I decided that we both had a break from jobs temporarily, and we better go and do one last expedition before we got tied down for the rest of our lives. And so we dreamed up something we could fail at, which was to go out to the Himalayas and attempt to run along the length of them.
Yeah, well, why not?
Yeah, yeah.
Where did that come from? Where did that idea, how do you come up with an idea like that?
Well, I think it gives some idea of the environment I was in, that I'd been lucky enough to be brought up in and in fact was living in at the time, that we could even conceive of bringing up those sort of ideas. But actually what happened is myself and my brother and one of my cousins were together one evening in a flat in London, wondering what my brother and I should do for this last big trip. And we literally sat and span a globe and said, oh, shall we cycle across Siberia or paddle across the Atlantic or run across the Himalayas? Ooh, running across the Himalayas sounds fun. And quite why we must have been very naive to believe we had any hope at all of even, beginning it, much less finishing it.
Yeah. How do you plan an expedition like that in 1983?
Well,
you didn't Google it.
You didn't Google it. You basically get quite a large envelope and start writing on the back of it. And you know the story about planning expeditions on the back of an envelope or a napkin. Basically, we seriously didn't know. We knew so little. We had no idea what might stop us. So we basically got an airline map of the Himalayas at about one to a million scale that we were going to navigate with. Got our passports and our air tickets and a lot of vaccinations and flew out to start the trip, and nothing ever became a big enough of a problem to stop us. So it was a very good example of a trip where you don't really ask why should I? You ask why shouldn't I? And in that case, nothing actually stopped us.
That's pretty amazing. Do you look back and at it now and think, what the hell were we doing?
Well, I absolutely do. I'm pretty sure I would not go and repeat it. But I also look back and I say to myself, we clearly spend far too much time in this day and age worrying about potential problems that haven't occurred yet. And I think it would do a great many of us a lot of good to just look at what we'd like to do and go and try and do it and wait until you get stopped rather than pre-planning to the point where by the time you go, you've solved every problem you could ever come across.
And that's an interesting philosophy. I mean, it's almost like one step beyond the what I say is the yes problem that adventure racers have.
Yeah.
You ask them to do something weird or stupid or crazy, and most of them say yes. And then they think about
it. That is correct. But, in an adventure race context, what it means is not, don't pore over maps of the area you're going to go to. Don't obsess over the gear you're going to need. Just go and toe the starting line and see what happens from there. And, it's possible you'll come across a problem that can't be solved, but it's odds on. There's a way around everything, and you find yourself at the finish and you say, oh, that was fun.
So and here's where the jumping around part starts. Is that how you do adventures now? Do you just, not literally, but sort of literally go somewhere and just do something?
Not really. I mean, now I have, I'm burdened down with the experience and the knowledge that I know there's a lot of things I need to check and double check and make sure I have the best piece of gear. But I certainly mentally go to an event, and I don't fear what the organizers might throw at us, or I don't fear how long a section might be, or how hard a section might be. I certainly know that it's got to be possible for somebody, and it might as well be possible for me and my team. So, that takes a lot of the sort of mental baggage out of the equation when you can just approach a race as, let's look forward and see what gets thrown at us. I'm sure we'll be able to handle it.
That's Now, that might be, this sounds kind of funny, but that might be the most profound thing anyone's ever said on this podcast.
Well, I'd be very honored if it did make the top 10 list of profound things. Thank you.
Well, it's definitely in the top 10 because that's just a really, really cool philosophy. So take that to heart, everybody. Yeah. Well, okay, so that was your last great adventure. I guess we don't have anything else to talk about.
Well, the interesting thing is we seriously invented that trip to run 2,000 miles across the Himalaya, knowing our odds of accomplishing it were absolutely minimal. And when we in fact did it, we were as surprised as anybody else was. And it's in some ways sort of dogged us forever, because it meant that from then on we were never able to turn down a challenge. So whatever strange event or strange trip a friend or an event promoter, you know, suggested, we would certainly be there ready to go. So it's led to a lot of fun, but we may have lived a quieter, simpler life if we'd failed at that and gone home and said, well, I guess that's the best we'll ever do. We'll stop now.
That's kind of sad.
Well, it would be sad to do that, but luckily we didn't do that. We finished, and ever since then we've broadened our horizons and been lucky enough to do an awful lot of fun things.
So when you finished something like that, so that was 83 or 84?
That was 1983.
What happens when you get done?
Well,
you didn't put it on Instagram, so what?
Well, you get 15 minutes of celebrity, and we went back to Britain and found out quite a lot of people had been following us in the newspaper. So that was fun, and I then pretty soon moved over to California and had to sort of, make a name for myself again. My elder brother and the cousin who had been involved in choosing that trip, running the Himalayas, they went on and did several high-profile expedition-like events in the UK, and have continued to be pretty well known for outlandish events over there.
So we're getting close to adventure racing.
Yep.
Getting close. But what was the most bizarre adventure that you did that came directly from running across the Himalayas?
Well, we did get invited to do a running race up Mount Cameroon in Cameroon, West Africa. Oh. And the Guinness Beer Company that has a brewery out there flew us down to challenge the local running talent, and we got to spend a week in the Cameroon and run up their local mountain with about 100 locals, and we actually did halfway okay. I think we ended up 14th and 15th, and my brother, who is definitely a better athlete than I ever was, was the first between us, but I think I'd got back to about just one place behind him by the time we finished. But that was certainly an outlandish adventure and a very strange sort of chapter in my events.
Yeah, it's always scary when you have to go someplace and race the locals.
Yeah, it is.
Because you know they're fast.
Yep.
All right, so you moved to California. What was the first crazy thing you did when you moved to California, other than getting married?
That was definitely an early on crazy thing, which I did pretty quickly then. Yeah. But I think, what I did, in fact, was realized that I should try and find out what some of these ultra running events were, because I don't think at that point I'd ever done one, and I don't think in Britain they had anything that was technically a, you know, a fully organized running ultra event. So I guess there was the London to Brighton run that had been going on for many years by that time. But really, ultra running was a new thing. Northern California was a hotbed for it. And so my first Christmas here, I went down to the Bay Area to some of my wife's relatives for Christmas or New Year. And I heard about an event on the coast called the Fat Ass 50, put on by a guy called Joe Oakes, who some of the ancient ultra runners may remember. And it was a very low-key 50-mile race. And I drove over to the coast, could not find the start of the event, but and gave up after a little while, drove a few miles down the coast and went for a run in the hills. And when I got back to my car, there were a couple of people running down the road who looked a little bit like they might be in an event. So I fell in with them, and it turned out they were indeed the front two runners in the Fat Ass 50 that year. And I proceeded to run and hopscotch with my car the rest of the 20 or 30 miles to the finish and hang out with the race at the finish party in a pizza parlor. So that was my first introduction to adventure, to ultra running here in the U.S., and it was quite a weird way to become involved in a race.
Yeah, that sounds Well, I'm seeing a pattern. We're just going to call that normal for Adrian. So, all right, what was the first organized ultra then?
Well, and then once I realized that there were these things, I got in tune with how to find out about them properly. And I actually, probably only the second race I tried was the Donna 100-mile ultra run, which was held out of Reno, Nevada. And I believe it only ran for a couple of years, or possibly even just the 1 year I ran it in maybe 1984. And one funny story from that is I went up and ran the race and got a pretty good finish, sub 24 hours for sure, and may have been the top 10 in a small field. But on the way back to my hotel, in the car, I stopped at a freeway overpass where in the morning I had thrown a sweater I was wearing down the side as dawn came and it warmed up a little. So I parked the car, jumped out of it, staggered down the freeway bridge on very tired, stiff legs. And when I turned round, having picked up my sweater, there was a police car just pulling up behind my car. And as he sees me stagger back to my vehicle, he comes over and asks how much I've had to drink. And I had to tell him, "Oh, I've had nothing to drink, officer. I've just run 100 miles and my legs are very stiff."
And he's like, "Oh, yeah, I hear that all the time."
That's right. Well, luckily he said, "You know, I think I heard something about that race happening." So he believed me. And, of course, if you speak with a British accent, you can get away with quite a lot of things. So.
Yeah, I've experienced that with people. How did you find out about races in the 80s? I mean, in with the group?
There was a magazine called Ultra Running Magazine. Okay. And I think in the annals of journals and newspapers, it probably has a pretty interesting history, but there were in fact quite a few ultra running events already happening, a lot of them being on paved roads rather than trails. But ultra running was an established sport, and every ultra runner in his right mind would subscribe to Ultra Running Magazine, which listed all of the upcoming events and had race reports on all the past events.
You'd send a letter off with a registration and a check, and you'd go get to do a race.
Absolutely, yep. And that was how it worked. It was all done through the mail, yep.
Yeah, you want to say it was the dark ages. It was like, that was like, what, 30 years ago.
Yep, that's right.
So, Who or and got you into the first your first adventure race?
Well, really what happened was I was actually reading one of these copies of Ultra Running magazine, and I turned the page to a race article, and the headline was, "Nobody Dies at the Alaska Mountain and Wilderness Classic." And it's a pretty shocking headline, and I read on, and it turned out that this really did sound like a race where one might be expecting to get a couple of people not making it to the finish and perhaps not making it at all. So, you know, this really piqued my interest. And the following year, I went up there as I think the only the second person from outside Alaska to try the race, and competed in the Alaska Mountain and Wilderness Classic. And the reason I say this in response to a question about my first adventure race is that in many ways the Alaska Mountain and Wilderness Classic was more like an adventure race than it was a running race, because you had to navigate yourself, you had to support yourself. Most people carried a pack raft, which was pretty novel back in those days, and you used the pack raft to get across rivers or to paddle down rivers. A couple of guys carried skis so they could ski over some of the big snow fields up on the higher routes. One time, one guy even carried a parasail and was planning to leap off the edge of a mountain range and make a few easy miles. So it was a strange event, and it was very adventurous because the rules were merely start here, finish there, and don't leave anything on the way. And it was a multi-day event. I think the times tended to be 3, 4, or 5 days to get to the finish. So it was sort of very similar to an adventure race, and although you could run it solo, just about everybody, for obvious reasons, stuck with a companion through the race because it was pretty extreme territory.
Yeah. Well, according to the Adventure Race Cooperative, that's the first official adventure race, and I have the beanie for winning, for knowing that. So,
well,
that
hey,
we're going to say.
Well done. Well, I think it certainly should share the evolutionary history of adventure racing with things like the New Zealand Coast to Coast race. So,
yeah.
So that's the answer to that, but if you ask me the question again and say, you know, bona fide recognized adventure race, I have another answer.
Okay, well, what was the first bona fide adventure race?
Oh, it's interesting you asked that, Randy.
hey, I've been doing this for like 5 years. I know all the questions.
So in the early 90s, I was actually a pretty handy ultra runner. I was doing a lot of ultra running races, but I also did quite a bit of orienteering. And in 1995, I got a phone call from Barbara Alvarez, who was an ultra runner that I knew from Western States and similar events. And she said, "Adrian, I know you're a pretty reasonable runner, but you can also navigate, can't you?" And I said, "Yeah, I like navigating. I'm not too bad at it." She said, "Oh, good, because we need a navigator for this race called Eco Challenge that's being put on. Do you want to join our team?" And I just said yes, with knowing very, very little about it, because that's what you do, yes. And it turned out I signed up for the Eco Challenge Utah, and it was Barbara Alvarez Angelica Alvarez. It was her twin sister who was Barbara. So it was Angelica and myself and three other women. And we came in seventh in the inaugural Eco Challenge, which is pretty good.
So that's a little different that it was, well, a women's team.
Well, I think we've all seen really good performances by women in adventure races now. Without a doubt, the fact that our team had somebody who could navigate made a big difference, because I think a lot of teams didn't have somebody in that caliber. But it was a fabulous race, great experience, as they all are, and I was very proud to have done well with a team that was four women and one man.
Are there lessons from that first race that you still use?
Well, I think there definitely are. I'm not sure whether they're truly from that first race or whether they began. My rules probably began from that first race, but have been refined as the other races happen. But I think that you immediately realize an adventure race is a little different. The important thing is to get you and your teammates to the finish line. You quickly realize that there's nothing happening in the world outside of the race until you cross the finish line. The most important thing probably is to keep your teammates in good enough spirits and good enough health that they can move along as fast as possible. And that's, I remember realizing that fairly quickly in that event. And that's probably been the most important lesson to learn for an adventure racer.
Yeah. Do you think, though, that your background, like mountaineering and with your brother and stuff, you probably actually kind of already knew that?
I suppose I did, but I think between my brother and I, we knew each other so well. You didn't have to actively think about how to keep one another going or to figure out how they were feeling. So it maybe hadn't registered with me, although you may be right that I'd already realized when you're mountaineering, you're always, making sure everybody's okay and whatever.
Yeah.
But it definitely was brought home to me in that eco challenge that it didn't matter how fast I was or how strong I felt. We were only traveling at the speed of the slowest member of the team, which luckily was not me. So, anything we could do to make that slower member feel as good as possible and as strong as possible was going to be an advantage.
So, yeah. So when did the Stray Dogs come together?
Well, as you probably know, Stray Dogs actually came together in the race in Utah, I believe, when the remnants of a couple of teams bumped into each other going in opposite directions and said, hey, we might get on better if we pool our resources. Meanwhile, hopefully, I was many miles ahead of them at the time. But it was actually only after having done well in Eco Utah, we were one of the 12 teams invited to the X Games Adventure Race in New England. Mm-hmm. And Angelica Alvarez wanted to put together a really top team for that. So she had myself and her, and we put our heads together and chose three really good ultra runners and athletes, and ended up with Tom Possett, who was a nationally ranked ultra runner, Marshall Ulrich, who, the kind of things he's capable of.
Yep.
And I think it was Whit Ramback, who was a very strong young adventure racer at the time. And so the five of us went to X Games New England.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that race? Because I mean, I've known a little bit about it, just from being at Untamed a few times. But,
yeah.
I mean, adventure racing was part of the X Games, people.
It was. It was kind of interesting because the adventure race was the first race the first race they started in the X Games that year. And the X Games went on for about 7 days, and it was the last race to finish. So I wasn't there to see in the stadium, but apparently they would keep putting up clips of how the race was progressing on the stadium videos. as the whole X Games unfolded over several days. So that must have been kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But we pushed pretty hard. We were up against Eco Internet, who, of course, were a very good team, and the Australian team that were really strong. But we were battling in the top three for a lot of the way, and late in the race, we were actually in first place. One interesting fact about that New England race was that halfway through, each team got put onto a private jet and flown from somewhere in upstate New York down to the coast to begin a tremendously long ocean paddle past Martha's Vineyard. And we were in the lead, but during the ocean paddle, I actually fell asleep, and the team paddled past the checkpoint where we were meant to turn in and stop. And so we lost a couple of hours there, and the Australians passed us, and of course their forte was paddling. So we trailed them in second place into Rhode Island, but we had pushed so hard, we were very sleep deprived, we were getting astonishingly clear deja vu moments as we paddled down the coast of Rhode Island. Every time we went around the point of a bay, I would be saying to myself, oh my gosh, I remember when I came here before. I know exactly what this is going to look like. And I'd never been to that part of the country. But it was quite extreme. And eventually we carried the boats across a pretty wide peninsula, managed to get across the harbor in Newport Beach to the finish line, and then basically the whole team just collapsed and slept for 24 hours.
So, and that's Eco Challenge X Games in a nutshell.
That's
collapse
right.
Collapse and sleep.
Yep. So. In fact, when we got back to the lodging that they took us to, I got in the shower, and an hour later they had to break the door down because I'd just fallen in the bottom of the shower and fallen asleep under the water.
And in a hotel, you're not going to run out of hot water. So.
Yep.
I think I'm right. You did all the eco challenges.
That is correct, yep.
So what – this is a really – open-ended question. What changed in 20 years?
Wow. Where's 20 years take you from? 1995?
Well, let's just say from the last Eco Fiji to this one.
Okay. Well, that's – I'm not sure an awful lot changed. I mean, Eco Fiji 2019 – which was the most recent Eco Challenge, was a fabulous event. It had, you know, it was a real adventure race, but it certainly was also a TV production.
Yeah.
They didn't interfere with the race at all, but there were just a lot of cameras, a lot of production people around. And a bit of a different vibe, but you know, once you're off the start line, you're it's like an adventure race. It's neat when you're doing an event that has a lot of resources because they can do really, really fun stuff, like give you different styles of boats and give you entertaining checkpoints where they bury treasure and make you pick up medallions. So that's all fun, and it doesn't detract from the adventure race, and it certainly, you know, I'm sure it adds to the visuals in the production, which I've generally heard, you know, I thought they did a very good job on, and I've heard most, you know, everybody I've talked to has said they enjoyed it, whether they were an adventure racer themselves or not. So I think they were very successful with both of that, and I think they managed to do it without without removing the adventure race from it. So I'd say that relatively little has changed in the, 17 years since Fiji 2002 and Fiji 2019.
Do you remember any of the Fiji 02? Because when I asked Nathan, he's like, I don't remember any of it.
I certainly remembered quite a bit of it when I was reminded during Fiji of things. So I did remember it, and I've always made pretty copious notes on all my races and, in fact, all my trips. And as an aside, I would encourage any adventurer or trekker or traveler to make their own personal notes, because your memory is pretty questionable. And it's nice to go back after many years and reread and remind yourself of what really happened in some things. But I was able to reread my notes from that first Fiji race prior to this one and remind myself and say, oh, that's right, I remember now. And sure enough, there were a lot of similarities, but a lot of differences.
Yeah. So did you guys know that you were going to be kind of a featured team before the race?
Not early on, but once we got to Fiji, they started taking more interest in some teams than others, and those were the teams that ended up being featured. So, in the week prior to the event, we realized, we were one of the ones earmarked for them to keep a camera on if they could, and we didn't know prior to the start line that we were likely to be a featured team.
Does that affect you in any way while you're racing?
No, it didn't. It absolutely didn't make a whit of difference to us during the race. I sort of don't think it would. I mean, you're not going to race any different. You're going to race as hard as you can regardless. So, no, it didn't. It really didn't alter the feel or the of the race or the way we did it.
Well, I mean, my feeling is you get used to that person, extra person around you, and pretty soon you don't even think about it.
I would say that's true. Yeah, I mean, we had an embedded cameraman for some of the sections, but it really doesn't make much difference to what you're doing.
Yeah. I get a lot of times people actually like it because then they have somebody different to talk to than their teammates.
I think the guys I've been traveling with usually I've sort of interacted with the team continuously and the camera guy's been doing whatever the heck it is he's doing. And you know, of course, you're very nice to them and you say hi, but I haven't wandered along and had long chats with them.
It's probably a little different when I'm out there because it's like I know them.
You go.
There's that part. So, how do you rate your race from a personal standpoint? How you guys did compared to how you maybe your expectations?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I'd know for sure initially my expectations, and I shared with this with the team is, look guys, we're all pretty aged. Nancy was 62. The rest of us were, I was 64. And Marshall and Bob were both 68, I think it is. So, there had to be some questions about how on earth we could perform. And we basically looked at each other and said, look, we're here in Fiji. We are going to get to the start line. And whatever happens after that is gravy. And I know once we were a few minutes into the paddle at the start, we said, yoo-hoo, we're really in another eco challenge. And every day that the sun came up at dawn, we would look at each other and say, yeah, we made it to another day. So, you know, we were enjoying the experience and being pretty pleased with our progress as it was, whether it was measured in time or in miles. But certainly it turned out to be sad that, you know, Dr. Bob got sick, because astonishingly, I think we could have finished if he'd been feeling better and we'd made better progress early on.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you guys don't look old, but like, I'm the same age, so you should look old.
Well, and we really hope that, you know, we'll get an entry to Patagonia and be able to prove that, yeah, you really can finish one of these things even with an old team. So.
Yeah. Do you, and this may be more of a media type question, but do you think your chances of Patagonia are good because you guys were a very compelling story? And I'm sure people would love to see you.
Well, love to see you back again. I'm hoping that's the case. Certainly the you know, production team must have thought we were a pretty good story, because they gave us a fair amount of airtime, and I would hope that they'll feel that about our application for Patagonia. But I also think, strangely enough, the fact that we didn't finish in Fiji may make somebody say, you know, these guys have got a good story going, now let's give them another chance, see if they can actually finish it. So That is what I'm keeping my fingers crossed as, and we'll give it a shot.
You know, that's a – I never thought of that, but, yeah, it almost makes you wonder if interesting teams that didn't finish have a leg up.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. No. There is some sense of that.
I think we just bummed out a bunch of teams that finished.
Yes. Yeah.
So – you also write, because I want to talk about the book a little bit.
Hope, thank you very much.
We, you know, that's kind of how we got hooked up, finally. But, and you wrote a book before. You wrote about running across the Himalayas, which I'm curious, can anybody find that anywhere?
Yeah, you can find it on Amazon. And okay. I think it's, there's probably only used copies around now. But I am, now that I've figured out the book publishing process, I'm hoping to republish that book as well.
Yeah. Get it on Kindle.
Okay, will do.
I love books. I love reading. And I probably have 15 on my Kindle that I'm reading at one time, because I love being able to, like, read a little bit of this and think, oh, I want to go read this, and it's right there. But,
okay.
So how did – all right. So you got to tell me the whole title, because I won't get it right, the new book.
Well, the title is The Truth Zone, Adventures and Misadventures Climbing California's 14,000 Foot Peaks.
Yeah. Where did that come from, and what's the genesis behind the project? This may be the because the project probably came first, and then you decided to write a book?
Yes. The correct answer to that is yes. But what happened, I think, is that after Fiji 2020, after Fiji in 2002, there were some more adventure races. I did a Primal Quest and some other adventure races. But we didn't have Raid Galois and we didn't have Eco Challenge annually. So I was doing a little more mountain climbing, and I had a friend in Modesto who had always wanted to climb Mount Shasta. And that, you know, it's a nice climb. It's no great shakes. But I took her up Mount Shasta, and as we approached the top, she said, if you just get me to the top of this mountain, I won't ask you to come up any more mountains with me. And I was like, oh, fine. You know, so we get to the top of that mountain, and she was thrilled to climb Mount Shasta in winter. And we start back down again, and we hadn't gone but a few thousand feet down. And she says, you know, Adrian, what can we do next? Take me up another mountain. And so that's partly why it's called the Truth Zone, is you don't believe anything anybody says above 12,000 feet. Okay. But from that, I made the rather glib and naive suggestion that maybe we should climb all the 14,000ers in California, which I didn't realize would take quite as long or be such a big task. I had at one time held the record for running around the Colorado 14ers, and there's 54 of them. So I thought, 14,000-foot mountains in California won't take us anything more than a summer. But actually, it took us about 4 years and a great many entertaining trips. And so the book is really the story of all those diverse trips and quite a lot of adventures and quite a lot of misadventures on the way.
Yeah. And I'm going to tell you what I really liked about one of the things I really liked about the book was it's like, oh, I know that person. Oh, I know who that is.
Good, good.
So if you're an adventure racer, you're going to know most of the cast of characters in there.
They're probably going to know quite a few. There's a big group of our Gold Rush volunteers and organizers with Gold Rush Adventure Racing came along at one time on one or other of the mountains.
Mountains, yeah. So what's the state of the Gold Rush group races? You know, what's happening with adventure racing from your point of view with all this hoopla going on?
Yeah, so we've got, I like to use the term refreshed enthusiasm for adventure racing. And so Gold Rush just published its events for the beginning of next year. So we're going to put on clinics and orienteering events and then one adventure race in 2021. And hopefully people who've been turned onto the sport by the World's Toughest Race are going to be able to come to our events and learn the necessary basic skills they need, which is the map and compass a lot of the time, and be able to tackle an adventure race somewhere.
So very, very cool. But, I mean, you guys are probably seeing the uptick in messages and emails and
absolutely
all that. I'm hoping that we're going to, you know, well, maybe not us, but they're going to look back in 20 years and think, man, it all started again in 2020.
I think it will. It was, you know, a lot of fun back in the late 90s when everybody was jazzed about adventure racing and it was America's new sport. And it's good to see a resurgence right now.
So just a couple of more things because, you know, you probably got an adventure to go on tonight. But what do you think about, and you've seen all these people that, I watched Eco Challenge. I love it. Got a team together. We're going to go to Patagonia. I mean, I love their enthusiasm, but do you, and you may not be the right person to ask because your first adventure race was an Eco Challenge. But
well, I think the answer is if you get invited to the race, you know, the Eco Challenge organization will absolutely look after you and your safety. So that's one big sigh of relief. The thing is, I would actually say, you know, go for it. That's been my philosophy all along. I usually tell people who ask me, how should I prepare to run my first ultra or how should I prepare for my first adventure race? I usually tell them, well, just go fill out the entry form and go do it. You'll either find that you perform a lot better than you expected and you finish, or you don't make it, but you'll have learned a heck of a lot more about how to do it by doing that than you ever would by me talking to you for a while. So that's my advice.
And then there's, and the third option is you don't like it, you don't come back.
Well, and there's always that possibility, but then we've wasted a lot less of your time if you go and try it and find you don't like it than if you spent 3 years preparing and then tried it.
Exactly. So this isn't a question, but it's an observation. So while we're sitting here talking, this adventure race thing is so big that I saw Kyle Peter comment on a post while we're talking.
Oh, very good. Imagine that. It's reached to him. Okay.
Yep. So, okay, here's my last question, and it's I'm going to ask it in one word. One word. Everest.
Ah. Okay. So I have I was enamored with the idea of Everest forever. It wasn't, in fact, until I went to the Raid Galwaz in the Himalayas in 2000. And in Kathmandu Airport, I was waiting for my gear with a lot of other adventure racers when there was also a guy picking up his gear who it turned out was not involved in the adventure race. And I said, well, what are you here for? He said, oh, I'm climbing Everest. And I sort of looked at him and said, what do you mean you're climbing Everest just like that? And he said, oh, yeah, I'm joining a team that's going to go and attempt Everest. And it was only then that I found out, oh, ordinary people really can, you know, have a chance to climb Everest if they want. And that was just the very beginning of that being the situation. Since then, of course, it's become more common knowledge that it's pretty easy to join an expedition if you really want to and you're willing to write a check. So I, in fact, went to Everest in 2005 and 2007 and 2013 and still have not quite made it to the top. But in my defense, I've climbed more or less solo without Sherpa help to this point. If I ever go back, I'm going to have to find myself a Sherpa to help out. But I've actually tried to try and be my own expeditions, and there's a long learning curve on Everest, so I'm not sure it's the easiest way to climb the mountain, but I've had a lot of fun and a lot of adventures going to and from the mountain and indeed attempting to climb the mountain.
So that's Adrian, you're one of a kind.
I'll take that as a compliment from you.
It is an extreme compliment. And like, write some more books.
All right, I would love to.
So
as soon as I stop adventure racing, I'll start writing.
That's true. So will maybe we be meet up in Bend next year?
I fully intend that. Yes.
Okay.
So the Bend Expedition race will be the place to be in May of next year.
Yeah, and you know, go ahead and give out some penalties to my friends. I don't care.
Tell them to behave themselves, and I won't have to.
Okay, that's the promise. So
okay,
that's been great. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
It's been very nice. Thanks to you, Randy, and thanks to all the adventures racers out there who are listening to it. Thanks.
Yep, they'll enjoy this one. All right, well. Just say bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
World. And although most men are hoes, he goes on the down low, cause I never heard about him with another girl. But I don't sweat it, because it's just pathetic to let it get me involved in that he said, she said crowd. I know that ain't nobody perfect, I give props to those who deserve it, and believe me, y'all, he's worth it. So here's to the future, cause we got through the past, I finally found somebody that could make me laugh. You so crazy, I think I wanna have your baby. Got bait. A body like Arnold with a Denzel face. You saw that I'll never forget. Yeah. He keeps me on cloud nine just like a pimp. He's not a fake wannabe, trying to be a pimp. He dresses like a dapper dumb, but even in jeans, he's a content original, the man of my dreams. Yes, my man says he loves me, never says he loves me not. Mine, I rush me good and touch me in the right spot. The other guys that I've had, they try to play all that Mac shit, but every time they tried, I said, that's not it. But not this man, he's got the right potion. Baby, rub it down and make it smooth like lotion. Yeah, the ritual, highway to heaven. From 7 to 7, he's got me open like 7-Eleven. And yes, it's me that he's always choosing. With him, I'm never losing, and he knows that my name is not Susan. We always had heavy conversation for the mind, which means a lot to me, cause good men are hard to find. My man gives real love, and that's why I call him killer. He's not a wham bam, thank you ma'am, he's a thriller. He takes his time and does everything right. Knocks me out with one shot for the rest of the night. He's a real smooth brother, never in a rush. Shit, he gives me goose pimples with every single touch. Spends quality time with his kids when he can. Secure in his manhood, cause he's a real man. A lover and a fighter and a knocker, knocker out. Don't take him for a sucker, cause it's not what he's about. Every time I need him, he always got my back. Never disrespectful, cause his mama taught him that. I got a good man.
What a man, what a man, what a mighty good man.